Hey guys, welcome to the Uprising Podcast. My name is Everett Foster. I am here with Stephen Willis, as always. We are talking to you about something really kind of a little controversial today. We are going to talk about an interesting paradox that has arisen and is a specter haunting the literary world. And that is the paradox that exists between diversity in books and cultural appropriation, and the question of who gets to write what. This is something that I've got some sympathy with, because I have a friend, and I may have told this before, please bear with me if you heard this. I have a friend that had a publishing contract with a big publisher, and he submitted a book, and it was basically rejected, and they said, okay, rewrite this, but include some diversity. And he did, and he got some criticism for that. But on his next book, he attempted to include diversity, but he was criticized, and it was a few years later when this book came, he wrote, and he was criticized for the book being considered cultural appropriation. And so this creates a kind of a catch-22. How do you include diversity in a book? How do you include, and this is not just superficial diversity on the terms of race or gender or religion or whatever. How do you include diversity while you're being pressured not to commit cultural appropriation? And that's a pigeonhole that I think a lot of writers struggle with. It's something I struggled with when I was writing about Japan, because I kept thinking at the back of my mind, and this was about 2013 when this is kind of at the height of its of the cultural appropriation hysteria, and that is, how do I react to this if I'm criticized for being a white guy writing about Japanese people? But, you know, that's something that Stephen and I are going to experiment with today. We're going to explore. We're going to talk a little bit about it, because it is something that I think most writers are going to struggle with at some point in their lives.
Certainly. And just the stories that we've heard since we started the Uprising Review from writers of all backgrounds, it's been really fascinating to me as somebody who was just really turned off by the whole literary community. And so I just kind of shut it out. It seems laughable that, for some reason, from my perspective, writers by nature are good researchers, and or they become good researchers because they need to be. So the idea that you can't write about, you know, a different culture is just very, very perplexing to me, because it just seems so obvious. You know, you've got to put in the work and do the research. And I think maybe cultural appropriation is often viewed as, you know, making fun of a culture, or, you know, offending them because, you know, you don't understand the culture or something. But I think more often it's not so much offense as, you know, you just come across very ignorant.
Yeah. So this to me brings up the time-honored saying, write what you know. And that, to me, can be interpreted two ways. It's either write to the culture you come from, write the place you come from, write the time you come from. If you are from Texas or from California, you're expected to write a novel about Texas or California, and a New York Jew is expected to write about New York Jews, and a Frenchman can only write about life in France. But what about, you mentioned research, what about the ability to know what you write rather than write what you know? What about the ability that I, as a historian, have to research the past and say, okay, I know I'm never going to get a 100% complete understanding of medieval Italy, but I think I can get a handle on it well enough to write a good story. And I think I can treat it in a respectful way, even though it's not my culture and it's not my era either. I think I can treat it respectfully. And that to me is really sort of the essence of cultural appropriation. I think maybe people who are worried about cultural appropriation are just kind of worried that they and their culture are going to be, and their people, and culture ultimately comes back to people, to your nation, to your race, to whoever you are, because that is one of the ways people define themselves. And it's people worrying that others are going to exploit them, especially for monetary gain, and simply saying, you know, stick to your own culture rather than write mine. But that to me, I kind of mentioned this a second ago, I have as much purchase on Japanese culture as I do on medieval culture, because neither one of them are something I belong to. But I have as much purchase on medieval Japanese culture as a Japanese person does, because neither one of us belong to the medieval era, right? So who are they to write about a time they don't belong to? In the same way, who am I to write about a culture I don't belong to?
Yeah, and flipping it and putting it in terms of time is really a great sort of compass to really judge that, because it's very, I mean, the culture even from just the 1970s to today is vastly different here in America.
Yeah, absolutely. This kind of reminds me of something. I don't know if you've ever heard of this or not, but do you know the book Silence by Shusaku Endo?
No.
Great book. It recently made into a movie. The movie flopped by Scorsese, but the book is great. It is about two Portuguese Jesuit monks that go to Japan during the Sengoku period, where Japan was essentially isolated from the rest of the world. You couldn't go there. If you landed on the shores of Japan, you would be killed. And Christianity was illegal, and they had a thing called the Hidden Christians. I'm not going to even deign to pronounce the Japanese name for it, because I can't. But these were people who essentially practiced Christianity, although they were Japanese. And there was a point in Japanese history, shortly after the war, the sort of Nobunaga period. I'm not 100% certain what you'd call that. Maybe warring states isn't exactly accurate. But it's the consolidation of these Japanese fiefdoms into one nation. And the persecution of Christians that came later forced these people to go underground. And so what happened is that these Jesuit monks were essentially forced to apostatize. And I'm not going to ruin the book for you, because it is good. It's a very good book, and I recommend it to everyone. But it really kind of speaks to the question of culture and how culture works. Because what happened is that after Matthew Perry, Commodore Matthew Perry, not the actor from Friends, came to Japan and opened the shores, we realized that one of two things had happened, and that is that either the Jesuit monks from Portugal had taught these hidden Christians a Christianity that was so vastly different than what existed in 19th century America and 19th century France and the people that started trading with them, that either it was so different than what they believed because Christianity had evolved in a way that we don't understand in the West, or because these Japanese Christians had kind of assumed or kind of mingled Shintoism, the ethnic religion of Japan, with Christianity, and simply put Christ and Mary into a position not unlike one of their other gods, one of the many gods of Shintoism. So, you know, that is something that is interesting about culture and the way that culture changes over time. So culture isn't just a function of place. Culture is a function of time. And, you know, these people have as much purchase on Christianity as does the Pope, really. But yeah, that to me is interesting, is how do you view a kind of a cultural mashup, and who gets purchase on it, and who gets to say, this is mine? Should something like Japanese Christianity simply not exist because it's foreign to Japan? And this comes to something that we call in the right, we call as purity spiraling, and that is, who is more pure than the other? Who is more extreme than the other? Who is more whatever than the other? And you see it in actually a lot of political and religious movements, purity spiraling. I'm more pure than you. I'm more Christian than you. I'm more right-wing than you. And that is an interesting phenomenon that I see cuts across politics, culture, religion, race, nationality, time. And it really comes back to the issue of cultural appropriation, and that is, who does it belong to? Because really, you as a writer are an individual. What culture do you really have purchase on? I mean, if you're from Tokyo, can you really write about Osaka? I mean, it's just a bizarre question, isn't it? And that is, am I not allowed to write about things that are not like me?
Yeah, and I think this hysteria about it is, it's very odd to me, because I just, I was considering, I've been learning languages, and I was considering, or have been considering, I've got a writing challenge on my website, and it's but I was considering maybe possibly kind of adding one as where it would be, learn a language and discover that culture, or probably just discover that culture. I guess you don't really have to learn a language, but that was kind of just plays into my interest. And then write a story in that culture. And so it's just such an odd concept to me. I constantly think of you know, how I don't know, was it a couple of years ago, there was this whole thing, you know, someone wanted to change the name of the baseball team. I can't think of it's.
Is the Braves?
The Redskins.
No, that's a no, Redskins are a football team, and that's been going on forever. But the odd thing is that a lot of the Native American tribes who look at this are like, you know, hey, Redskin used to be an insult, but we like this team. We love their logo. They're kind of cool. And it's basically a bunch of white liberals who are offended for him.
Right. No, I remember hearing this Native American guy. He just said, this is stupid. Like, it's not, this isn't offensive. And so, yeah, it's just, I think cultural appropriation most of the time is really just one group being offended for another group when there's either no fault done or it's really, you're not offensive. You're just, you know, you maybe didn't do enough research into this culture, but it's not, it's hard to put a number on it. But I would honestly say, you know, from just from how often I keep, you know, we keep hearing this phenomenon of cultural appropriation. I could easily imagine it being, you know, 95% of the time, it's not really the case.
Yeah. And it's not like the Washington Redskins are called the, you know, Boston runaway slaves or something. I mean, it's not blatantly retarded. It's just, it's a name that people have gotten butthurt over for no reason, apparently. And that is really, you struck on the heart of cultural appropriation. And that is, it is bored white middle-class college students looking for a cause, and they're looking because we in America and in Western Europe live in, and in many parts of Asia live in such a really nice world. We don't have that much to complain about, really. So we now are finding microaggressions and mansplaining and manspreading and really, you know, people just getting offended because, you know, you didn't know which one of the 38 genders they belong to. You know, it's just absurd. But, you know, people who claim cultural appropriation don't know how culture works, because culture is a function of things that don't normally go together somehow commingling, usually because of war or invasion or trade. So, and I've said this before on other podcasts, and I'll say this again, the really good places to eat are places that have been invaded a lot or did a lot of invading or had trade routes and ships, because you've got, you know, the native ingredients of one area mixed with the spices of another, and then you just come up with something really cool and really new. And it works the same way in literature. It works the same way in music. You know, American country, the sort of southern country, the pop country, I guess you could call it, is a product of pop music and country music, sort of the outlaw country of the 70s and 80s, the Willie Nelson sort of country, you know, the Luckenbach, Texas kind of country. And rock and roll is its own thing, and then heavy metal is its own thing. And people who are familiar with the history of music or the history of art will understand that when you mix different things, you come up with new movements. You come up with things that are original. And sometimes it's discovering something from the past, like a neoclassical movement, but sometimes it's just a mixing of things that didn't necessarily go together, and there's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, like, but it plays into the question of diversity, and that's something that we really need to talk about as well, and not neglect, and that is the question of diversity in books, the question of diversity in science fiction. You know, how do you, there's this push right now for diversity. Everything has to be diverse and multicultural, and diversity is our strength, and that kind of a stuff. How do you view diversity? You're a little younger than I am. You're still an undergraduate in college. How do you view diversity? You and I think are from different generations as well. I'm Generation X. You're a millennial, I think. How do you view diversity? How did you grow up with that?
I guess I'm very skeptical of, not so much the concept of diversity, but what the underlying meaning is of diversity. Like when you know, I see a declaration of diversity in a you know, in a classroom. You know, I think every college has some sort of declaration of diversity in their bylines or whatever. I've always been very, very skeptical of what that really means, because I'm very in tune to, or I have been very in tune to politics for a long time, and just seeing, I guess I understand a lot more now than I did then, but I just saw it as a very ideological thing as opposed to something that was very necessarily welcoming, because it's just, I feel diversity in a lot of ways isn't so much something you have to, you know, declare on a piece of paper. It's something that's sort of natural. You know, I've never been one to sort of see a different, you know, see someone of a different race or different culture and really, you know, put a whole lot of weight into that. You know, of course, you know, learn from different races, learn from different cultures, respect them for who they are. I feel like that's kind of natural and not necessarily something that, you know, needs to be said all the time. So that's kind of where I come from.
Yeah. To me, it seems like diversity is a cult, because people are enthralled to the idea of diversity to the point where it supersedes every other value that they have. And the worst part about the cult of diversity is that, well, there are a lot of really bad things about the cult of diversity, and that is, first of all, diversity usually just means less white people, because we don't talk about diversity in China. If I wrote a novel about China, nobody would expect me to have black people in it. If I wrote a novel about, but it, you know, there's like that show Vikings. They now have black Vikings and lesbian Vikings and all other Vikings, and I just kind of stopped watching it. And you know, recently we saw a kind of a medieval, I think it was a King Arthur movie that came out, and it you know, it has like black people in medieval England, because there were totally a lot of black people in medieval England. But diversity is something that you have to have now, but it only applies to white cultures. Nobody would complain if there were not black people, or if there were not black samurai in the 18th century. But if you have, you know, King Arthur's court, or, you know, like that new movie, it just came out with Emma Watson, Hermione, Beauty and the Beast. You know, you have these wise black people in pre-revolutionary France. Yeah, because there were a lot of them around, right? To me, it just seems like it's an encroachment on white culture, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, if you want to talk about cultural appropriation, putting, you know, different cultures into, you know, the Vikings, I don't know how you get more culturally appropriated than that.
Yeah, and if anybody has reason to be offended at cultural appropriation these days, it's you know, white Europeans, because their culture is being essentially overrun with diversity. And like in that show Vikings, I shared you the video. I won't tell the viewers which one it is, because that will give them very bad ideas. But I showed Stephen a video critiquing the way that Vikings treated Christians in the first season of Vikings and the way they treated Muslims in the second season. And it was radically different. But you would never see Hollywood treat Christians with dignity or respect in the same way that they treated Islam with dignity and respect. And that's pretty much where I stopped watching, because I just thought, this is complete bullshit. This is retarded. I'm not going to watch this. I'm not going to give these people my time or my money. And that is not even cultural appropriation. That is just cultural denigration, forcing diversity into a culture where it just doesn't belong.
Yeah, you know, science fiction is kind of a rough one for culture, you know, trying to figure out what is the culture of the future. You know, what happens when we meet another species? And, you know, like in Star Trek, we all kind of, the whole world sort of became, I mean, it you know, if we had that sort of technology, it would be very fascinating to see where as a world we would go culturally. And that presents a very unique challenge for any, you know, science fiction writer sort of trying to explore those ideas.
So yeah, we're talking about race and culture and cultural appropriation and who gets to write cultures. Let's take this to its logical conclusion and say, if I as a white person am not allowed to include Asians or blacks or Native Americans in my fiction because of cultural appropriation, or if I'm not allowed to write in their cultures, am I allowed to write about women too? Or should I keep women out of my novels because I'm a man and I don't know how to write women?
Right. I mean, a lot of times, I've actually seen writers use this, use gender, not, as a man writing a woman, to, you know, as even a strength, as a very, sometimes that could be, objectivity, you know, looking at, you know, a woman's thought process from a man's perspective and, you know, writing that character. And I think we can do the same with culture and say, you know, we can be objective about this culture because we're not a part of it.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it. It really, maybe it takes a person standing outside of culture to write about it. But I also really believe in the national novel. I believe in nationalism. I believe in the national novel. I believe that people coming from a certain culture are going to necessarily represent that culture. And I think, you know, women writers are going to necessarily represent women, not necessarily better, but in a different way than men would, and perhaps in a more accurate way. But I kind of, you know, I get a lot of really positive feedback from my novels where people say, I love how you write women. You write women so well. You know how they think. And it's like, you know, that's a real compliment to me. I love that. But yeah, that is its logical conclusion. We have this paradox of people saying, okay, we need more women being visible in literature, but you're not allowed to write women because you're a man. Or we need more black people being visible, but you're not allowed to write them because that would be cultural appropriation. And I think this is one of the things that's causing the breakdown of the regressive left and the social justice crusades. It's an inherent contradiction. You can't tell people, we need more of this, but then you're not allowed to write it. It's just not, it doesn't make any sense. And jumping on people for deigning to do that or for daring to step outside of their own comfort zone. You know, am I not supposed to write gay people? You know, I mean, we are supposed to have positive representation of gay people in the media. Should only gay people write gay stories? Or is that something I'm not supposed to do? It's stupid.
It's very stupid. And like, was Vladimir Nabokov not supposed to write Lolita because he's not a pedophile? I mean...
Well, he was a college professor. I joke. But, you know, there is a lot of that going on college campuses these days, it seems. But, yeah, it, you know, are we not supposed to write murderers because we're not murderers? Can only a gangster write about gangsters? It's the most ridiculous premise that I could possibly think of. And because it's based on the notion that you are not able to understand things that are not a part of you. And that is, to me, a fundamental contradiction of human nature. One of the things that makes people human is we can understand things that are not like us. I mean, that is one of the things that makes us not like the chimpanzees. Chimpanzees do not go forth and try to understand bonobos or gorillas. Humans do. And that really speaks to the mission of Uprising Review, our free speech mission, because part of free speech is the right to speak, of course, but it's also the right to hear what is being said. And I've said that many times, and that comes from John Milton's The Areopagitica. I recommend anyone read it if you haven't. It's available for free from Gutenberg Press or Project Gutenberg, I think is what it's called. But yeah, human nature involves the ability to reason and think and understand and judge things that are different than you. And that doesn't mean you're being disrespectful. That doesn't mean you're being evil. And that doesn't mean that you're oppressing anyone just because you chose to write in their culture.
Yeah, and I think you hit on something else there that's really key in that, you know, we're trying to stop all these writers and artists from you know, writing about different cultures, different ideas. And there really is no logical end to it. You're absolutely right when you say, you know, you can't, I mean, if we accept the premise that I can't write, you know, have a main character that's black if I'm white, then we also have to accept, you know, I can't write a character that grew up in, you know, Minnesota because I'm from Arizona, things like that. But right now we're seeing the very same thing in politics where for some reason, one side cannot fathom understanding the other side. It's creating these odd divisions and it's kind of confusing. And we're like, wait a minute, let's back up for a second. You know, this is your cousin or your friend or whatever. And, you know, you can't, bring yourself to at least, you know, understand where they're coming from. It's really, the same thing. You know, we're being told as writers, you know, we can't write another part of a conversation. We can't write a character that grew up differently than us or disagrees with us. It's that same problem, but I think that's how that manifests itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is something that's very true. I don't want to get on a political tangent here because this is Uprising Review. We're apolitical. even though I am myself a very political person. But, you know, that speaks to a lot of what we're seeing in politics today. We have gone from simply looking at the other side and saying, you're wrong, I disagree, to saying, you're evil, I have to do something about you. And that is why you have things like the Battle of Berkeley. That is why you have things like Base Stick Man. That is why you have things like Moldy Locks, Antifa, the alt-right. This is, you know, whenever you attempt to shut someone down by calling them a Nazi, you're not simply saying you're wrong. You're saying you're evil. It's not a political judgment. It's a moral judgment. And that is really one of the reasons we've become so hostile politically these days. And I think that's also true of novels and of culture in general. When critics look at something they disagree with, they tend to paint it as morally reprehensible, not as wrong, not as bad art, but as something that you have an obligation to not just not watch, but to oppose. And that is really destructive to art, really destructive to free speech, really destructive to culture.
Absolutely. And I think this sort of, you know, fake outrage over, you know, a different culture that we're seeing in writing really lends to this sort of very unhealthy political atmosphere where suddenly we can't disagree with somebody.
Yeah, and, you know, John De La Rose talked about this in his op-ed, you know, that he was essentially removed from his position as a member of a convention in his area because people disagreed with him over Trump. And I have lost friends recently because, you know, my politics, and, you know, it's people I've known for 18 years. And, you know, one day I realized that, hey, you know, this guy hasn't talked to me and his email bounces and he's not on my Facebook anymore. And, you know, and what am I supposed to make of that? Is that the point where we've gotten where people are like, not only are you wrong, but I don't want to be associated with you because you are immoral. And that is really something that speaks to, it's a product of the same kind of political and academic, ultimately this comes from the Frankfurt School, academic school of critique, that is social justice. It is the notion that you are obliged to engage on this crusade to end privilege, I guess. That's the thing we've kind of danced around here, is the question of privilege. And, you know, I'm sure that many of the people who consider themselves social justice types, progressive types, liberals, would look at you and I as white males and say we have a privilege, but, you know, I really don't. I mean, I'm pretty poor, and you're a college student, so you're pretty poor as well, I'm assuming. You know, I do not come from any background of privilege, I assure you. I have struggled for a very long time, and so did my family. And, you know, I'm, if people have heard those previous podcasts, I'm not going to go into this here because it's too much, but, you know, I am one generation removed from subsistence farming in Europe. That is not a valid way of discrediting someone by saying privilege or white privilege or male privilege or cis privilege or het privilege or all these other stupid privileges that the social justice academics have come up with. But that is a key component that we need to fight, the question of privilege, the concept of privilege, because it really is their one weapon that they use to beat people over the head with in this cultural appropriation versus diversity debate.
Right. And it really is an attack directly, I think, on free speech.
Absolutely. And, you know, here's something I've been exploring in some of my columns on alright.com, and that is the question of censorship. And people have this tendency to say, well, if the government doesn't censor it, it's not censorship. A corporation can censor you all they want. Oh, good, liberal. So now you're on the side of corporate rights. You're big on corporate power. Is that where you're at now? Are you going to next stand up for the right of Ford to export jobs from Detroit to a right-to-work state? Are you going to stand up for the strike breaking? Are you going to stand up for the bankers on Wall Street? Is that where you're at now? But, that is a sign of the insanity that has become culture in 2017. And it is an attack, ultimately, on the nature of man itself, that we are a free creature, that we have the ability to explore ideas, that we have the ability to explore things that are uncomfortable. And so what we have instead of political censorship is corporate censorship and advertising censorship and ultimately self-censorship, because if you're worried about your reputation to the extent that you're just not going to talk about something, how is that different than a government putting a stamp on it and saying you're not allowed to talk about this? There is no real difference. If you willingly pull your punches, there's no difference between that and a government saying you're not allowed to talk about something, because the end result is the same, and that is silence.
Yeah, and I think for, you know, writing and, you know, fiction specifically, you know, that really, and I know I've probably said this before verbatim, but it really should be a place where we can explore new ideas, or explore controversial ideas. You know, the freedom to just sit down and write about, you know, a controversial topic in fiction, even if I don't agree with it, maybe, you know, I just want to explore, you know, maybe a certain type of evil or just a different perspective is very important. And this narrative of, you know, being cultural appropriating is just so unhealthy to art and to writing fiction.
Yeah, that is absolutely spot on. And there's so much we could say about the politics of diversity and cultural appropriation. I will say one thing. I recently, not recently, a couple of months ago, interviewed a woman named Bree Fauché, who is an alt-right writer, who is also a YouTuber, and she got into a lot of trouble over a video she made defending a fellow writer, YouTuber, because this writer did not have enough diversity in her novel. And Bree was attacked, and that's kind of how I got to talk to her, and I interviewed her about this. If you're listening to this, go to YouTube, look up Bree Fauché, and look up her video on diversity, and just see what she has to say, because that is a really interesting perspective on it. But yeah, there's so much we could talk about here. We're going long on this podcast, but I think we're probably going to wrap this up here quickly. If you guys have any questions, comments, concerns, you can email us at podcast@uprisingview.com. Stephen, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
You know, just that this whole paradigm has spanned politics. Just the other, this last week, I think, there has been a published author who's very liberal and, you know, I guess a very vocal group of other liberal writers or critics were very, very critical of the way that she approached a topic that, if I remember correctly, I think it was just the topic of racism, but they didn't like how she approached the topic. And she is now just very scared and very unsure of what she is going to do.
Yeah. And, you know, they're really, it wasn't that long ago. It was really in the 90s that you had the kind of, I'm not so sure it would be exclusively to the religious right, but there was a period where there were people like Jack Thompson going around trying to ban video games and ban art that they thought were causing violence. And people blamed school shootings on movies like The Matrix, and they blamed it on video games like Doom. And today we see that in games as well, where you have people like Anita Sarkeesian going around saying games are causing people to become sexist. That's absurd. And it was stupid whenever Jack Thompson did it, and it's stupid now. But the whole cultural appropriation diversity thing, it is a symptom of a larger problem. And that's something we need to address on other podcasts. And it would actually be fun to get George on here and just get her perspective on it, because she is very liberal and very progressive, just to see what she says. But yeah, the one-time religious right that simply was anti-fun has really turned into the social justice regressive left, as Dave Rubin calls it. Or, yeah, I guess it's Dave Rubin who calls it that. But yeah, we are going definitely along here, coming up on 40 minutes, and I think people are getting bored listening to us ramble about this. But yeah, we could talk for a long time, and I'd like to talk more about this. But yeah, so you guys, if you've enjoyed our podcast, email us, questions, comments, concerns, talk to us. We love hearing from you. podcast@uprisingreview.com. Log onto our website and read new stories every Monday, uprisingreview.com. We have new op-eds coming up. We have podcasts every week. If you're listening on iTunes, give us a rating, leave your feedback. We listen to you. We do listen to what you have to say. If you have suggestions, absolutely. If you have questions for us, we love hearing from you. So yeah, that does it for us. And we hope maybe this has gotten a little, maybe it's reached you in a way that you didn't understand before. Maybe it's provided some perspective on social justice and on diversity and multiculturalism. Maybe, and that's in a way that you didn't think about. So, yeah, we would love to hear from you guys. So for Stephen Willis, I am Everett Foster at uprisingview.com. thank you for listening.
He came that day when they all gathered round in Berkeley, oh Berkeley, that old hippie town. They came to see what freedom could be when we all stand together against that commie Red Sea. All hail, Basic Man.